Welcome to the Not Just a Pony Ride podcast, presented to you by Hetra University. If you've landed here, you're probably passionate about how horses help people. This podcast is for anyone who helps others experience the benefits of horses or those who have experienced it themselves. If you're in the equine assisted services industry, we're here to help you. If you're here just to learn more, you're in the right place. Welcome to your community of like-minded people, where you will hear stories, education, science, and explanations about how what we do is so much more than just a pony ride. And now, from the Hetra campus in Gretna, Nebraska, here's your host, occupational therapist and CTRI, Katie Ott.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. Today I have a very important member of the EAS community on our show. She was here in the very early beginnings of what our industry is now, and I'm excited to share her with all of you. So today I have Dr. Octavia Brown, and she was actually born in England and emigrated here when she was 22. So since then, she has been involved in the early days of equine assisted services. She was actually one of the founding members of NARA, which is now what we know as PATH International. So she was actually in the room at the very first meeting of kind of this idea of, hey, we should put together an organization for what we're doing with therapeutic riding, then therapeutic riding, now adaptive riding. So very, very just rich history in our industry. And today we talked a lot about where our industry has been, what it looked like, kind of the history of it, and now where it is. She shares with us what she thinks some of the pivotal moments of our industry was in what has really been instrumental for our growth, as well as some of the challenges that she sees and kind of where she sees our industry going. So very excited to share her. She has just credentials a mile long. She is a master instructor. She was awarded the James Brady Award, which is PATH's highest honor for lifetime achievement in therapeutic riding. It was really just an honor to get to soak up her knowledge and experience and pick her brain a little bit today. So enjoy. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Octavia Brown. Before we get started, what we'll do is I'll have you just introduce yourself. And why don't you tell us your credentials and kind of how you ended up where you are now?
Well, as you said, my name is Octavia Brown. And as you can tell from my accent, I was born in England, but I came to this country when I was 22. And sooner or later, I got myself involved in what's now called equine assisted services. I'm a member of the PATH organization, Professional Association of Therapeutic Horsemanship. I'm a master instructor. I'm also an equine specialist in mental health and learning, and I'm an emeritus professor of equine studies at Centenary University in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Before that, I created the first program in New Jersey. I was co-creator of the first state organization, HRH of New Jersey. So I've been around in this field for more than 50 years. So I have a lot of background.
Yes, we're excited to learn more about your journey in the equine assisted services industry and kind of where you've seen the industry come from. So do you want to talk to us a little bit about, you know, your early years? Were you always a horse person and you kind of stumbled into the therapeutic side?
Yes, that's an exact description of what happened. I started riding when I was 8, like many English girls. I was sent off to summer camps every year. I never had a horse of my own, but rode really from that time on. And then when I got to this country, as I say, at age 22, I was in Massachusetts, in Cambridge. The first thing I did was buy a car, and the second thing I did was buy a horse. And so I started riding again after some years. Basically, that put me in touch with somebody who worked at McLean Hospital. McLean is a psychiatric hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. And the lady who was in charge of the art department was from Germany, and she had heard of what's now therapeutic riding. And she was looking for someone who might start something with McLean Hospital. And that someone turned out to be me. And so eventually we got four horses on the grounds at McLean, and I was teaching the patients at that time. Now, you have to remember that psychiatric patients in those days would go to hospital and stay for months at a time, unlike today. And so the horse program was part of what they call activities therapy. And I was coming in completely out of the cold, but I knew horses. So I became part of the activities therapy department. And as such, patients would come and I would teach them lessons. And then I would report on their progress back to the psychiatrists and the halls where they lived. So, and I became fascinated in the effect that the horses had on these psychiatric patients. They would arrive at the barn and their face would be kind of blank-ish. And then they'd see the horses and all of a sudden there was light in the eyes and there were smiles. And then we would ride and we would do horsemanship lessons and all of that. And this became for them a piece of reality in their hospital life. I became known as the horse lady. And so that's how I got started.
I love that.
Somebody sent me a clipping from the publication, The Chronicle of the Horse, that said that a group of people were thinking of starting an organization for therapeutic riding. And if we all went to New York City, we could learn more about it. So I hoofed off to New York City, sat in a room in a hotel, and there must have been about 20 of us in the room, and they formed the board of what became NARA and now PATH from those 16 or 20 people in the room. And I am number 16. That is my number. So I was part of the founding board of what now is PATH International.
Incredible. Tell me about that. I mean, that meeting, what was the early days of forming an organization for our industry? What was that like?
Well, it turned out that Lyda McCowan was one of the chief architects of that. And she was tasked with creating something to do with children and horses. And she went to England and found out about the Riding for the Disabled Association in England at the time. And so basically, NARA was modeled on that idea. So she went there and she talked to all their specialists and she came back and said, we need to do this. So we did.
I love that. Tell me a little bit about, do you know much about what they were doing in England? Is that where kind of our industry, is that where our roots are? Tell me a little bit about the history of our industry.
So the history basically goes back to the 50s when polio was all around the world. And in Scandinavia and in England, they have a history of ponies, small horses. And somehow the people in the rehab centers had the bright idea of putting the patients who were recovering from polio on the ponies and giving them a pony ride. Mm-hmm. And they found that, oh my goodness, they loved it. And it strengthened the muscles that had not been affected by polio. And then people started thinking, well, maybe there are other kinds of disability that we could use with this. So they basically began thinking along the terms of more therapeutic use of the horses and ponies. And then those organizations and others in Europe began to create their own organizations. And then we followed along. So that was the trajectory that it took. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. at the time, it was truly therapeutic riding. It was not considered therapy. It was not conducted by physical therapists. It was just riding instructors giving people a nice time on the horse or the pony, and noticing that there were physical improvements and cognitive and emotional improvements that went along with it. Mm-hmm. Hippotherapy, the use of the horse, or the employment of the horse, I should say, in terms of physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech, came much later.
That makes sense. So in the early days, there obviously wasn't a certification or anything like that. Were you present kind of then when they decided to start doing some kind of formal education and certification for instructors?
Yes, I was. And the very first place where you could go for training was, again, with Lyda McCowan and the Chef Center in Michigan. And because of her involvement from England, she set up an instructor training program. I was one of the first group that got certified under Lyda. And then she was on the board of NARA at the time. So, and I was a board member too. So between all of us, we started to think about certification. And then, you know, that came along a few years later that we would start some sort of certification program for instructors.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? I mean, obviously we've grown a lot as an industry, but kind of through the years, what do you think were kind of pivotal points in making our industry progress through the years?
Well, one was when a group of people, basically volunteers who put this whole thing together, decided to create a national office and employed somebody to be an executive director. And first of all, it was in, I think, Virginia, and then eventually moved to Denver. And that created really a functional organization that could handle things on a national basis. And then the other key thing is when, again, the therapists in this country heard about training in Germany and sent a whole group of physical therapists to Germany to learn what hippotherapy was all about. Mm-hmm. And they came back and said, we have to do this. So they fundamentally created the American Hippotherapy Association in conjunction with NARA. And eventually, of course, that group went off on its own path. And they now, of course, certify and evaluate therapists. Mm-hmm. So we created the two, basically fundamentally two different streams. One that really was associated with more of a therapy approach, and one that was more along the lines of the adaptive riding.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that they had such a far leap on some of this equine assisted services? Is the horse more, I'm not very well traveled, is the horse more commonplace over there?
Well, every country has its own culture. I should segue to say that there is an international organization, Horses and Education in Therapy, I think it's HETI, which has countries as members. And I was at one point on the board and also president of that. So I got to visit a number of different countries. And I observed that the way the countries developed their system sort of depended on their approach to riding. So Germany, Austria, Switzerland, places like that were much more concerned with therapy as such. England, Scandinavia, Spain, Italy, many other countries were more concerned with the recreational and adaptive side of this. Not that they don't all do each other's thing, it's just that the culture kind of dictated which direction the equine professionals would be going in. And I think you're right that certainly, you know, growing up in England, there's a tremendous horse culture there. And it's all about riding cross country and having a nice time and learning some dressage and learning how to jump and basically just enjoying yourself on horseback. Mm-hmm. Whereas in some of the other countries, it's much more controlled. The lessons are very formal. There's a formal progression that you have to go through. And so that kind of lent itself a little bit more to the hippotherapy idea. But that's all history now. Long ago history. Now, every country does a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think the shift came from being more of and it still is a recreational thing for lots of folks, but where do you think it took the turn from it being just this nice thing we can do to really being something that complements, you know, healthcare and mental and physical wellness and kind of being more seen in that professionalism lens? When do you think that shift occurred and what happened?
I think it really did begin when the hippotherapy part of this became so widely accepted. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to remember, most of the countries, not us, of course, have socialized medicine. And for them, this could be prescribed and paid for under the socialized medicine system. So they were really, I think, way ahead of us in prescribing for somebody who needed it, the hippotherapy approach. And then that would segue over time into therapeutic riding if and when the person was ready. In this country, there's a little bit more of a divide because you have to have a prescription. You have to make sure it can be paid for. Hippotherapy is expensive. Most adaptive riding is not anywhere near so expensive. So I think there's still some dividing lines there as to who can qualify for what service. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I also think we've grown a lot as an industry when we started adding some of the certification, of course, and then the formal education as well. So did I hear that correctly? Are you an educator, a professor of equine studies?
That's correct, yes. Mm-hmm. For 25 years, I worked at Centenary University. And so many of the universities that do have degrees now for adaptive riding, they are training the equine professionals to work with really all the varieties of equine-assisted service. Obviously, the therapeutic riding itself, but also to be the specialist for hippotherapy, for the mental health approach, for some of the other approaches that have been coming along. Mm-hmm. So what you have then under equine studies is you have people really well trained in every aspect. They can ride, they can train, they know business, they can basically be a partner, run a stable, muck the stalls, teach the lessons. So those of us who come from the college background feel like we're providing a really well-rounded professional for the future.
Yes, I would agree. The well-rounded and safe, you know, we're safe to deliver really effective lessons that are from a professional highly educated in all of those areas, definitely. Tell me a little bit about what you think the challenges might be for our industry. I mean, we've maybe overcome some obstacles and some hurdles, of course, through the years. What do you think a challenge of our industry might be?
I think you mentioned the issue of safety. I think also the issue of the equine well-being. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of emphasis now on making sure that our equines are suited for their job, that they're well cared for, well trained, have a good retirement possibility when their job is done. I think that's an increasing concern as people, you know, our population of horses tends to be a little older. Mm-hmm. They've got lots of experience before they come to us. So I think that's being addressed now in a way that it has not been before. And I think that's important. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think is kind of the interface among the different paths that EAS can take, from the counseling, psychotherapeutic approach, perhaps considering new populations like people with visual impairment or blindness, more emphasis on how to really teach people with a variety of different disabilities, and making sure our professionals are trained for all of those possibilities. I think those are challenges.
This episode is sponsored by Stable Moments. Did you know that there are over 400,000 children in the United States foster care system? Most of these children have complex trauma needs, which makes them ideal candidates for equine-assisted learning programs. If you serve or want to serve children in foster care, Stable Moments has a plug-and-play program model utilizing community mentors and equine-assisted learning to develop life skills and heal developmental trauma. With their online certification program, you can become certified in this model and start serving kids by next season. What's even better is the program can be funded by Department of Children and Families, and the mentors are all volunteers. To learn more, head over to stablemoments.com and check out their free webinar, Healing Trauma with EAL and Mentorship. Yes, I would agree. I think that it's difficult to ask an instructor, because I'm a occupational therapist as well as a CTRI. So I take off and put on these different hats at different times, which can be difficult. But I do think that it's important that our instructors have a good background in disability education, as well as how to make some of those adaptations, like for, you know, visually impaired, or, you know, if it's postural or physical or whatever it is, because those are the types of participants that they're seeing in real life, right?
Right. And I think you touched on something, you know, with having your foot in both camps, as it were, the interface between direct hypnotherapy services and the next step for someone. I think that we may not have prepared our instructors for that interface. You know, do they talk to the therapist? Do the therapist seek them out? Mm-hmm. Do they plan for that transition from one type of service to the other? And how much support and help could the medical professionals give to the people that they're handing over to? Does that make sense to you?
Of course.
Not sure if I'm expressing that the right way, but it's something that that I've seen work, because with my long experience, I know who to ask about with the right question to say, okay, this person was in hypotherapy for 3 years. What do I need to know that you can tell me, given the HIPAA regulations? How much am I allowed to be therapeutic? Mm-hmm. And how much am I allowed to be sort of more recreational adaptive? Mm-hmm. I think there's an interface there that we haven't truly addressed, perhaps.
Yes, I would agree. And I think we're very lucky at HETRA, at our center in Gretna, that we have therapists on staff, as well as obviously our adaptive writing instructors. And so we do have that interface quite often, where our participants will advance from participating in the hypotherapy and then, you know, advancing into adaptive writing once they get strong enough in some of those skills. And so we get to have a lot of that transition and that kind of a little bit of handholding between as they make that transition. And I think there are some centers that are not, don't have that benefit available to them, where they have therapists either on staff or, you know, really at their fingertips. And so how are we asking our adaptive writing instructors to make that without the help of another healthcare professional, like a OT, PT, or speech therapist? So I think that's interesting,
right? Yeah.
Transition.
Yes. The program at Centenary University, we created an in-house program so that our instructors in training would have people to teach, but we do not offer hypotherapy. So if anybody comes from that background, where's that connection? Who do we reach out to? How much information are we able to get? So I think for places that don't have the advantages that you do, there is sort of a gray area in there.
What do you think, what's your opinion about how much disability education should we be giving our instructors? How much, you know, how much should they know and be able to adapt to?
More rather than less is what I would say. I can only speak to the curriculum that I've seen and that I know other colleges have, where, no, you don't need to know the chemistry behind something, but you do need to know the physical manifestations of a disability. Mm-hmm. And if you ask somebody, for example, who has a spinal cord injury, what would they want you to know? Well, they would want you to know all of the problems that you might see, like, you know, the idea of contact with the saddle. What could that do to someone's sit upon, whatever you want? What about the side effects of medications that people can have? Without being a medical professional, you need to have, it seems to me, an outline of what that disability really entails, in both a physical as well as a cognitive and emotional sense. Mm-hmm. So the model that we used was to ask everybody in the class of instructors in training to focus in on an area and really research it and produce it for the rest of the class. Mm. So everybody could have a really pretty in-depth look at what it meant in terms of, in this case, adaptive writing. Mm-hmm. What would it take for this person to be a good candidate for an adaptive writing program? And so people would take a something like cerebral palsy and try to understand the different ways that it operates, understanding that you can't know everything about everything, but at least you have a resource to go back to and look at when someone comes through your door. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think you can do is give them sources of information to go when somebody with something you've never heard of comes through your door. So knowing where to look for something like Noonan syndrome, or I don't know, you name it, mm-hmm. the strange things that come across your desk. People should not be afraid to look at what's out there in Google land that mm-hmm. will tell you what the manifestations of it are. Mm-hmm. So I do think that more general education, not strictly medical, just the stuff you can find online, mm-hmm. they should have access to and be familiar with.
Right. And I think that PATH International has done a great job of setting up some good general like contraindications and precautions and things like that for us, which are very helpful. So if not, you know, really anything else, kind of understanding in general, what do we consider contraindications or precautions for adaptive writing?
I agree. I think the standards have been improving ever since they were created. And the the precautions and contraindications part is extraordinarily helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the other challenge that you talked about was kind of our equine welfare, our equine management side of things. How have you seen our care of our horses grow throughout the years?
I think people have come to realize that even just walking around for hippotherapy is stressful mm-hmm. for the horse, and that the horse needs to be well prepared for that, by which I mean ridden on a regular basis by people without disabilities in one way or another, so that their back is strong enough, their legs are strong enough, their hind end, their hocks are strong enough to carry the burden of somebody who cannot really move with the horse. Mm-hmm. I think we forget how stressful that is. So you or I might get on a horse and weigh 200 pounds or more and be fine because we move with the horse, our bodies are flexible, the horse carries us, we're one with the horse. But then you put that same person and they have no ability to move with the horse in their core. And the horse is essentially carrying a backpack slung low on its hips, which, as mm-hmm. we all know, is really difficult to do. We want that backpack up high on the shoulders, mm-hmm. is a metaphor, where the horse can carry it easily and stride along. Mm-hmm. So preparing the horse for that work, I think, is very, very important.
I love that metaphor. I've never heard it said quite like that. And I really appreciate that imagery because we at Hetra take a lot of pride in setting weight limits, like both for balanced participants, which would be like more able-bodied, can move with their horse, and then unbalanced, you know, weight limits where they don't, you know, are more like that low slung backpack. And I think it's important that we look out for the welfare of our horses, even though sometimes it seems to horse people that have been riding their whole lives, like the horse, you know, would be able to handle that. But when they do that day after day, you know, for several sessions, that wears on them in the long term.
And I think those ideas, the limits on how long a horse may do that work every day, that's important to mm-hmm. keep in mind. The other thing I think that my research has shown is that selecting the horse for this, it seems like the ones who've been done a lot. They've been around, they've been in trailers and out of trailers, they've been to horse shows, they've done all that. They tend to look at anything new and strange and say, oh, no problem. Whereas little old horse who's been in someone's backyard all its life is much more liable to take a long time to settle in, not always, but often. So mm-hmm. looking for the right mindset of the horse coming into the program, I think, is also an important consideration.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you've seen that camp of things and selecting the horse and having appropriate horses grow a lot from the early years.
Oh, indeed. Indeed, we have. Yep.
Are you practicing or, you know, assisting with any centers locally now, Octavia?
I still volunteer up at the Centenary Program, which is known as TRAC, Therapeutic Riding at Centenary. Mm-hmm. I handed over the reins of that 3 years ago, but I'm still a mentor for their instructors in training. Mm-hmm. And that's important because it brings in an outside pair of eyes to see the students as they get close to the CTRI exams and so on, and mm-hmm. to monitor their teaching. And then when our university students aren't here, I get to school the horses. Hey, so I still get to ride and try to keep myself fit enough to do that. So yes, that's important. Mm-hmm. And then I'm still very active with our state organization. So yes, I definitely do stay in touch.
Yes.
It would be hard not to, I think. But I try to pretty much as an advisor in the background. Mm-hmm. And I'm also mentoring people from a Long Island program. Again, they can send me videotapes and I can critique those and send them back. So being a mentor is really great because you don't know these people, so you have a pretty objective look at how they're doing mm-hmm. and whether they're likely to succeed as CTRIs. Mm-hmm. So I'm busy doing that.
How have you experienced the new CTRI process that has started in the last couple of years?
Well, it's being an old curmudgeon, I would still like to see the person themselves ride the horse. I know that was taken out of the process, but I think that's a little sad because I really would like to know that they can actually get on a horse and do something with that. Mm-hmm. I think it's evolving. I think it's improving as time goes on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just hope, though, that the pipeline to go further to the advanced level and then the master level, that will really still continue, mm-hmm. that people will see value in moving further up that ladder, mm-hmm. because those certifications really are for people who should be teaching the next generation. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we'll see people wanting to move up the ladder where it's much more demanding to become a master or an advanced instructor. Mm-hmm. So I think that I hope that we don't lose sight of that we have people going up that ladder.
Mm-hmm. What other value do you see in moving up that ladder?
Well, so that's one thing. The other is for those who want to consider teaching at the college level, you really should aspire to the master level, if you can, master instructor, because as in my own case, I have a master's degree in education, but I do not have a PhD. Mm-hmm. And when I was moving up through the college level, that master designation, essentially in our industry, is the PhD mm-hmm. of therapeutic riding. So I was able to move into the full professor and be eligible for tenure because of that. Mm-hmm. So on an academic ladder scale, moving up through the ranks would be important because that's your professional credential. Mm-hmm. The doctor in front of my name is actually an honorary doctorate that I was awarded from Centenary University. Mm-hmm. So, but I've earned doctorate is the master level for PATH.
Mm-hmm. I like that parallel. That makes sense. So then does the master level come after the advanced? Is that correct?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, that's correct.
What's the difference between the advanced level and the master level then?
Well, the advanced one is an on-site examination and it's very intense. Mm-hmm. You have to teach two sets of people, one with more involved in that with their disability, and one with people who are at a higher level of riding ability. You have to lunge a horse, you have to evaluate horses, you mm-hmm. have to take a written exam, and you can take that on site with a mentor, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's a full day of testing in order to get to that level, and it's really quite stressful, and that's because they want to show that you can stand up to that level and that you can, in fact, ride and lunge and evaluate horses for all manner of different kinds of use. The master level is more like a portfolio. You have to show that you've brought somebody without a disability up through various, so you take them, let's say they're beginning cantering. You have to show over like a couple of months that you have taught this person how to ride better. You have to do that. You have to show that you've got involvement with PATH in some level or another, committee work, something like that. And you put together this whole portfolio, and then that's evaluated. And again, it shows you teaching and all of that. So it's a bit more like a thesis kind of a business.
That makes sense.
Okay.
It makes sense why that is more of the PhD equivalent then, because that's what's involved in that as well.
Right.
Very good. Well, I guess kind of as we wrap up here, is there anything else that you would like to add about your history and experience in this wonderful industry?
Well, I feel that I was incredibly fortunate to dive into this when I did, because watching the whole industry grow from absolutely grassroots. And it's true to say that we were nice little ladies in wellies in England, stumbling around a field with kids laughing on ponies, all the way up to the incredible professionalism now we have, with so many different ways that we can involve people with equines. And to me, that's been amazing. And I would say to young people, when that door opens, don't hesitate to go through it. Just go on through. If it hits you on the way through, well, you know what? Another door will open after that. So go for your dream, you know, and get your education, get your training, and join in, and then rise up through the ranks and make things change and happen some more.
Very good. I love that. Well, thank you for, you know, taking some time out of your day and your busy schedule, Octavia. I appreciate that. And I know our listeners will appreciate it too once they get to listen.
It's been fun. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yes, of course. Thanks for listening to another episode. Until the next one launches, stay connected to our community by joining the Not Just a Pony Ride Facebook group. There, we share exclusive educational content, answer your questions, and review new and exciting developments for the EAS community. Don't forget, if you have suggestions for future episode topics or a lead on a great guest that you think our audience would enjoy, click on the link in the show notes or visit us at hetrauniversity.org. This podcast is presented by Hetra University, an educational arm of the Heartland Equine Therapeutic Riding Academy. Hetra University's mission is to provide high-quality educational offerings to our participants and the EAS community. If you'd like to help us work toward our mission, you can make a donation by visiting us online at hetra.org. Again, I can't thank you all enough for helping Hetra change lives one stride at a time.